This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
What are you going to do?
I'll build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
A scene from the 1933 film King Kong. That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in a theater spectacle. The soundtrack of the film, dialogue and music, has been released on CD. My guest, film historian Rudy Belmer, wrote the liner notes. His books include Inside Warner Brothers and Behind the Scenes. There are many things that make King Kong great. The special effects, the image of the giant ape climbing the Empire State Building, Fay Wray's screams, and the score composed by Max Steiner. Here's the main title music. Belmer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Bum, bum, bum.
It doesn't
sound as good when I do it as when Max Steiner did it.
Well, he wrote it.
Yeah.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score for this.
It's a wonderful score, and of course, he was a pioneer, certainly in doing sound motion picture scores. But if you can imagine that picture, if you turn the sound off when you're watching a cassette or seeing it on television, and you turn the sound off during the big sequences, certainly in the jungle and on top of the Empire State Building and so forth, and you realize how much the sound elements contribute to the success of that film, not only the sound effects that Murray Spivak created out of roars and grunts and groans and what have you, that he manufactured, but also the wonderful dramatic values that Max Steiner brought to it. Because, you know, at that time, when he was beginning to score that in late 1932, music throughout, in terms of a underscoring, was not prevalent. It was shortly after sound came in, and the emphasis was on dialogue. In fact, background scoring was relatively sparse. But Max rose to the occasion, and fortunately, Marion C. Cooper was a staunch advocate, and so was David Selznick, who was the executive producer at RKO Radio at the time. And they said, yes, we want a full-blooded score, and it certainly became that. And he, you know, he made that thing work from a dramatic standpoint.
I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're mm-hmm. watching this, you know, native ritual.
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this, like, march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward his prey. And the march is a very European form, and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But The music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
One of the things I love about the score is that Max Steiner did go all out. He obviously wasn't thinking to himself, oh, it's a stupid movie about this giant ape that tries to take over New York. I mean, he really got into it.
Well, that was one of the things about Steiner. He had the ability to get with the movie, whatever movie. Of course, his range was incredible. You know, he did Gone with the Wind later for David Selznick, and he did The Big Sleep, you know, which is totally different once again. And he did Little Women back at RKO in 1933, shortly after he finished King Kong. Now, you talk about a quantum leap. And he did a very quaint, charming period score for Little Women. I'm sure Louisa May Alcott would have been delighted. But here he got into it completely. And, of course, one of the major things is the willing suspension of disbelief, both from the people who are working on it and certainly the audience. You have to have that or it doesn't work. And everybody involved, certainly Marion C. Cooper, who, by all odds, you know, was the creator of this thing. You get people all riled up, and by the time Steiner got it, you know, he got all riled up. And he knew this was an opportunity to really come on.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their heathen tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Wait, easy now. Wait till I see what goes on.
Holy mackerel, what a show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium.
And
it.
frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
And that's from the soundtrack of King Kong, which has just been released on CD. My guest Rudy Belmer wrote the liner notes for it. Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams. So fortunately, she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a Tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which of course is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course you can do all kinds of things.
Well, why don't we hear a nice scene with plenty of screams and roars? And this is, I believe, the first time we actually see Kong. Fay Wray is tied at the stake during another one of these ceremonies. And this scene starts with the chief, played by Noble Johnson.
Karatane Kong. Otarave Ramo Kong. Wasaba Sanamaka. Otarave Ramo Kong.
It's a scene from the soundtrack of King Kong, which has just been released on CD. My guest, Rudy Belmer, who has written a lot about Hollywood movies, wrote the liner notes for the CD. Why don't we take a short break here, and then we'll talk more about King Kong. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rudy Belmer. He's written extensively about Hollywood. He wrote the liner notes for a new CD of the soundtrack of King Kong. Now, you know, Carl Denham is the character who's the American promoter determined to capture Kong so he can create a crowd-pleasing spectacle, you know, back in New York. And I want to play the scene where he explains why he needs a beautiful actress for the film that he eventually wants to build around Kong.
You never had a woman in any of your other pictures. Why do you want one in this?
Because the public, bless them, must have a pretty face to look at.
Well, Mr. Denham, why not take a picture in a monastery?
Yeah. Makes me sore. I go out in sweat blood to make a swell picture, and then the critics and the exhibitors all say, if this picture had love interest, it would gross twice as much. All right, the public wants a girl, and this time I'm going to give them what they want.
I don't know why you're going to get her.
You think I'm going to give up just because you can't find me a girl with a backbone? Listen, I'm going out and make the greatest picture in the world, something that nobody's ever seen or heard of. You'll have to think up a lot of new adjectives when I come back.
Where are you going?
I'm going out and get a girl for my picture, even if I have to marry one.
Well, Carl Denham is certainly determined to do anything he needs to do to make this picture. Any comparisons you could make between Carl Denham and the real director of King Kong, Marion Cooper?
Well, there are a lot of comparisons because Marion Cooper was, to a large extent, Carl Denham. And Ernest Schoedsack, his partner, who was the co-director, was to a certain degree the Bruce Cabot character.
That's the love interest of Fay Wray.
The love interest of Fay Wray, who was the first mate on the junket. And Ruth Rose was Mrs. Schoedsack, and she wrote the final dialogue script. And Cooper and Schoedsack had been partners for a long time. They had done a very important documentary called Grass back in 1925, and then they did another one called Chang in 1927, where they were actually over in Siam, which was called then and later Thailand, and shot there up in the jungles with the tigers and the elephants and so forth. And they were really adventurous folk. I mean, back then, this was a big deal, and the entire company was Cooper and Schoedsack. They shot their own footage, they directed it, they set it up, they got to know the natives. So this kind of an expedition, of course, was taken to its its fantasy element once again by King Kong, which was a conception of Marion Cooper's. When he was a young boy of about six, his great uncle gave him a copy of a book that was written in the middle of the 19th century called Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa by a man by the name of Paul Duchalou. And in it, he's describing these terrifying gorillas, which, of course, years later, we've come to realize is not the case. But this was before anybody had really gotten to study the gorillas. And this electrified Cooper as a little kid. He said, and he told me this back in the 60s, he said, from that point on, I knew I wanted to be an explorer. Well, he did want to become an explorer, and he combined exploring with motion picture making and then later on with aviation. And he was an incredible character.
Cooper refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong. And so they went with, you know, the puppet and stop time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different. And of course, there'd always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And, you know, that was fine, but he wanted to do something special. And when he saw, over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute, nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed and a foot. So that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, you know, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute. We built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion, he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45, you know. So it does keep changing, but he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in, but inevitably, I found through the years, he was right.
My guest is Rudy Belmer. He wrote the liner notes to the new CD of the soundtrack of King Kong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film historian Rudy Belmer. He wrote the liner notes for the new CD of the King Kong soundtrack. Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray in flimsy chiffon dresses and lingerie,
yes,
tied at the stake on the island or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in in The Most Dangerous Game, but he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
The blonde was probably a better contrast to Kong's dark body.
That's right. And he said, you know, he said to Fay Wray when he first talked to her about, he says, you're going to play opposite the tallest, darkest leading man. Because she didn't really know, you know. As she got into the thing, she realized what this was going to be, but she didn't understand how it was. Because a lot of the time she was up in a tree reacting to things that hadn't really been photographed yet, or, you know, screaming in a cave or doing one thing and another. And, of course, the putting together of this film, you know, it was very difficult to know exactly what it was going to look like when it was all put together. So she had to rely on Cooper and Schoedsack, and fortunately she knew them both, so that worked to her advantage.
What are the original materials that the new CD version of the soundtrack is from? Is it from the original film, or were there other things that were found in the vault?
Because of the age of the material, we're talking once again 1932, early 1933, there wasn't a great deal of pristine material available, but a gentleman by the name of Ray Fayola, who does beautiful work, did this for Rhino. He was able to get through the Max Steiner estate and Brigham Young University, which has the Steiner papers and the Cooper papers, incidentally. He was able to get these recordings that were made at the time. They weren't commercially issued. They were put onto the old 78s. There were two 10-inch 78s with excerpts from the score that Steiner had made up to give to a few of his friends. So those were preserved in the Steiner collection. Ray Fayola also found some outtakes or some alternate takes on the optical tracks of the time. This, of course, was long before magnetic tape. And he was able to work these things together into a suite and do a lot of audio salvation so that, you know, you could listen to something other than a lot of scratches and hisses and what have you. And he did a remarkable job. He chose to do a suite of the music rather than isolated cues because to keep the thing moving along, because some of the things on the recordings just abruptly ended since they were individual takes that were taken from the sound stage when he was doing the score. Steiner went from the acetate recordings they had then. So he was able to take these diverse elements and mix them together into this music suite.
Now, I understand you're still pursuing your interest in the directors of King Kong.
Yes, of course. ad infinitum. But fortunately, upcoming, I'm going to be doing a narration track on a separate track for Cooper and Schoedsack's 1927 Chang. This is the one they shot over in what was then Siam and is now Thailand, with all the tigers and the elephant stampedes and what have you. And we're also going to have some extras on that. That's for DVD. Milestone is doing it. So, and it's a beautiful print of the film. And it should be interesting because, once again, Cooper and Schoedsack were right out there in their element before they got to Hollywood. And the trials and tribulations of making that film, you know, with the cholera and the malaria and the sunstroke and the loose tigers and what have you. I mean, you'd think that it would be a rather dauntless affair, but they somehow managed to bring it off and brought it off extremely well. It's a beautifully made film.
Was Chang like a monster or an animal? Or
Chang actually was the elephant. And there were many elephants, and they did have an elephant stampede, which, of course, later on they used the elephant stampede, not the same footage, but in all the MGM, Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzans, they always seem to end up with an elephant stampede. But the prototype was shot for Chang. In fact, Schoedsack got under the ground and shot up one of those pit shots where you see the elephants coming over the camera.
Right.
I mean, it is just amazing. And the tiger leaping up into the tree where Schoedsack is shooting, they didn't think the tiger was going to leap, and he did, and he landed a foot and a half from the camera, and a big close-up of the tiger right into the lens of the camera. I mean, they took a lot of risks when they were doing these things. I mean, it was just incredible.
Rudy Belmer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure, And remember that big guy.
Okay.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got him.
Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty killed the beast.
Rudy Belmer wrote the liner notes for the new CD of the King Kong soundtrack on Rhino Records.